Here on WEAA 88.9. I'm Sean Yoes, your host. Thank you for joining us for our first 2 hours on this Friday. Make sure to follow us on Twitter at First Edition 88.9, and don't forget to like and follow us on Facebook at First Edition on WEAA 88.9 FM. Go to WEAA.org on our homepage for the latest podcast of First Edition, or subscribe to our iTunes podcast, First Edition. Also, hit me up on my personal Twitter account. The tag is at Sean Yoes. That is my name, S-E-A-N-Y-O-E-S. Or go to my Facebook page if you have information, insight, or breaking news you want to share with me. I'll share with the people unless you don't want me to, and of course I won't do it. Coming up in the second hour of the show, very excited to announce that Lady Breon, Mecca, Slangston, and Grimm, all from the defending national champion Louder Than a Bomb Spoken Word crew, will be on the world-famous Happy Hour. It is going to be exciting. They're going to spit live. We've got beats. We've got the whole thing. It's coming up in the second hour. I can't wait. I don't know what to expect, but it's going to be incredible. That's all I know. Stay tuned for the world-famous Happy Hour in the second hour of the show. Coming up a little bit later in the first hour, the Mod Squad will be here. That's Taya Graham and Stephen Janice of the Real News Network, reporting on law enforcement and politics, including some thoughts on Mayor Pugh's alleged plan to deter violence in Baltimore. That's coming up a little bit later. But first, our guest is none other than Lieutenant Governor Boyd Rutherford, Maryland Lieutenant Governor Boyd Rutherford. Lieutenant Governor, welcome to First Edition. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. I'm glad to be on.
So let's jump right into it. Recently, sure. There was you had an event, a town hall, I believe, either it was about the Project CORE, I think, if I'm speaking correctly. CORE obviously stands for Creating Opportunities for Renewal and Enterprise. Let's talk about your work with Project CORE here in Baltimore City first.
Okay, yeah, we had a town hall 2 days ago over at Toppin. We plan to have another one on the west side. We have, or the east side, excuse me. We haven't picked the date yet, but as you said, it stands for Creating Opportunities for Renewal and Enterprise, and it really grew out of when we were campaigning about 3 years ago in Baltimore, and the governor was taken back by the amount of vacant houses that we saw, and concern of a number of the citizens about the houses, the buildings that were derelict and in some cases falling down. And we knew that the city had a program to take down some houses during that time, but he wanted a way to accelerate the process, but also to bring development and, you know, community revitalization. And so our Department of Housing and Community Development came up with Project CORE, where the state is putting $75 million into demolition of these swaths of vacant properties. We will clear it, grade it, put grass and trees on those lots. The city is putting in another $18 million, I think $18.5 million to be exact. And then from there, we are providing financing for development or redevelopment, be it community centers with some of the nonprofits or parks, as we did over in the Matthew Hinton neighborhood, or housing that's taking place, mixed use or affordable housing that's going in, like at the lumber yard off North Avenue next to Coppin. So it's a project to get things moving, revitalize a number of neighborhoods. And the reason for the town hall was when I was on North Avenue talking to some of the folks there months ago, I realized that there was a lack of understanding of exactly what the program was and the role of the state and the role of the city. And so We had the town hall. The mayor was there. She brought a number of her officials from the planning department and from community development. And we had, of course, our Secretary Holt from Maryland's Department of Housing and Community Development and some of our staff so that we could explain what was going on, and primarily to the community organizations who were there.
You're giving us a lot to unpack here, Lieutenant Governor.
I have a lot of time.
It's good. I mean, but there's some things. Let's get to some of the things that you alluded to, and I would suggest that mm-hmm. one of the things that you said is kind of the operative narrative, if you will, in this political season, the delineation, if you will, between the state and the city. Too often people who need help most get caught up in the mix of that, unfortunately, and that's not to disparage either side, but it's right. I think it's a reality. You mentioned Matthew Henson community or Sandtown, as some people would refer to it. We have written in our newspaper, the Afro newspaper, about the fact that they are right now. If you were to go into parts of Sandtown, Winchester, the parts that encompass the Matthew Henson Development Center, Development Corporation, there are open air drug markets drug deals operating in broad daylight, probably as we speak. And it's an issue that Doc Cheatham, the former chair of the NAACP for Baltimore City, veteran civil rights advocate, has been talking. I know you do. He's been talking about this stuff for screaming at howling at the moon for a long time about these situations in Sandtown and all the initiatives that you and Governor Hogan have brought forward are incredibly welcome. But how do we begin to close the gap, if you will, between city government and state government, the city and the state, so in order for people to be served more effectively, I guess is the question.
Well, I mean, you said a lot that needs to be unpacked. I mean,
okay.
Because you're talking about, law enforcement when you're talking about the open air drug market.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
So, we do provide, the state, which includes yourself, because it's all taxpayer money.
Yes, sir.
Provide a lot of assistance to the city in terms of law enforcement, be it directly to the police.
Absolutely.
To the mayor's office, to the state's attorney's office. In the last couple of years, upwards of $63 million for law enforcement efforts. And so it doesn't help when the budgets of law enforcement get cut in the city. I know the mayor and the governor met just this week. I think it was Monday.
Yeah.
They met. I spoke to the state's attorney just yesterday in terms of what we can do and some of the things that can happen to help in the process. But in terms of what happens on the streets, and dealing with what you're talking about, the open-air drug markets, that really comes down to Baltimore City and Baltimore City PD. The state doesn't step in on that.
Right, understood.
That is not where we come in, and there's some things we can provide some assistance. I mean, understand, the state police, there's a little more than 1,100, maybe 1,400 state police officers, that those troopers are for the entire state of Maryland.
Understood.
Whereas there are over 2,000 Baltimore City, about 2,800 Baltimore City officers.
Well, right there, I think it really is illustrative of the issue. First of all, the city budget for law enforcement actually increased this past time around. There was more money for police, I believe, by $17 million.
There was some debate about it at one point.
Oh, there was definitely debate about it. But in the end, there was an increase in the budget for law enforcement.
Okay.
And additionally, you just made the point that there are more Baltimore City police officers, significantly more Baltimore City police officers than there are state police to service the entire state of Maryland.
The entire state, right. And they're not really trained to do the same thing.
No, they aren't. And the governor alluded to that. They aren't trained to do law enforcement in urban areas. So the question becomes, and again, this is a question that in a lot of ways falls through the gaps. But if you look at the state, if you will, of the Baltimore City Police Department and the difficulties, the challenges that they have encountered over the last few years since the uprising after the death of Freddie Gray. People ask the question, should we continue to throw money, if you will, at Baltimore law enforcement, or should the money be distributed in a different way? Should we look at different strategies, if you will, to fight against violence and crime in Baltimore City?
Well, I mean, you know, first of all, police have a very difficult job.
Absolutely true.
In Baltimore City, they go into very dangerous situations, and you know, and sometimes you don't even, you know, for those of us on the outside, some of the situations they go into, you would think are not very dangerous, like domestic violence. Those situations, I've talked to many officers, including the state troopers.
They can be incredibly
dangerous.
They feel
those are the most dangerous situations because they don't know who's who. The
Absolutely.
Person that they think is the victim turns around and attacks them. So I want to just, you know, state that, you know, we understand and support what these, you know, law enforcement tries to do on a daily basis.
Absolutely.
Now, your point in terms of a different approach, well, we know that what a former mayor did when he locked up 17% of the city population in 1 year wasn't the right way to go.
No, sir.
And some of us, including myself, think that, you know, that helped to cause the rift between the police and the community that led to the events that occurred a couple of Aprils ago.
Yes, sir.
So, I mean, there are some things that we can do different, and that's why we're trying to address the demand side of this heroin issue, heroin and opioid issue, because that drives a lot of the violence that goes on.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you're right. I mean, there are two places where all of this starts, not in terms of not the negative, but in terms of positive, the opportunity to have positive results. That's at home with families, no matter what the family makeup is.
True.
And you have a hard time, government has a hard time addressing that because we're too far away. We can try to make the playing field more level for families to take care of their offspring, but we have a hard time getting to the heart and soul and teaching people how to raise families and how to take care of their kids. Some of that is in the faith community.
Mm-hmm.
The other area our schools, and that is something where government really can help. And as you know, and probably most of your listeners know, in Baltimore City, there is a major problem associated with what goes on North Avenue. There's a lot of money that goes to, when you look per student funding in Baltimore City, you take state, federal, and city money, it's like the fourth highest in the country, but you're not getting the results.
No.
So somewhere along the line, it's not reaching the classrooms. When we talk to teachers or talk to family members and they talk about what they have to deal with and what they, you know, the lack of supplies, the books, the facilities, something's not right. And we think that there needs to be a different approach.
Well, I think we are absolutely on one accord as far as that's concerned. There is certainly nothing, there's something not right about the money not being able getting to where it needs to get to, as far as Baltimore City Public Schools is concerned. But also, I would suggest, or rather argue, Lieutenant Governor Rutherford, that money, resources for groups, entities, individuals that are doing incredible work in Baltimore City, whether it be educational, cultural, artistic, whatever, groups and individuals that are doing work to prevent violence, to help service families, mentorship, you name it. There are people doing amazing work in the city, but the money does not trickle down to the grassroots. It keeps going to the same entities, the same companies that have been doing work for a long time, not to disparage the work that they do, but there is a vital need for resources, for groups doing great things, and they're hanging on by a thread. And we just wonder how we can find a way to create an infrastructure that we will distribute those funds, those resources, more equitably.
Yeah, that's, I mean, I know that there are groups at the grassroots level that are working on shoestring budgets.
Absolutely.
you know, that they are really living on donations. They apply for grants, and in some cases they get them, and they're doing a lot of good work. And it's a question, you're right, is how to get that to them when they don't necessarily have the resources that a larger and more established entity, you know, nonprofits that have consultants or they're used to writing these grant requests versus kind of the storefront type of community centers that are really working hard. We've worked with some groups over in the Walbrook Junction area as well as Squeaky Kirk and his group. But what we've done there is brought in volunteers and private donations to help them. Not government funding, but it's people that we met, you know, just in providing customer service, you know, state services, and heard the stories, and we were able to connect them with individuals who are willing to volunteer and help in those areas. And there have been other places we've been trying to work, and we don't make a big deal about it. It's just trying to do the right thing.
Understood. You mentioned the opioid crisis, obviously, in the state of Maryland, in Baltimore City. And I know that you know because you've been working hard and intimately with agencies and individuals around the state and in Baltimore City. Obviously, Baltimore City has had an opioid crisis for decades.
Since I was a boy.
Yeah.
Before that.
Exactly true. Where are we at right now? We know that we have not. It's almost as if we can't keep up with what's going on because the naloxone, the drug that prevents or can prevent overdosing or reverse, for lack of a better term, overdosing. Doesn't seem like we have enough money even to purchase that drug. It's such an issue. Where are we right now, from your perspective, Lieutenant Governor?
You know, it's like jumping on a moving train. Mm. I mean, this thing's been going down the tracks for many, many years, and I like to feel that with all of the attention that is now focused on this whole issue, ranging from the heroin itself, but also the prescription opioids, which has really driven the surge of new users. I mean, you've had, like we said, in Baltimore, and when I was growing up, there was, you know, in the 1970s, late 60s, 70s, heroin was, you know, big deal in a lot of the cities around. Baltimore was always a heroin town, so you have what some will call the traditional heroin users. But the big surge that we're seeing, I mean, we had more people dying from heroin in Baltimore than they did in the 70s.
Right.
When there was a lot of attention to it back then. But the big surge is people who were taking those prescription opiates. And in many cases, like Percodet and some of the others, many cases they were taking it on doctors' prescriptions. And they became dependent, and it created this movement to heroin, which was cheaper and more powerful. And the cartels that were bringing in cocaine, they still are, but they're bringing in heroin now because they're business people, and that's where the demand is. Where we are, I would like to say that with the attention, there are more people that are getting into treatment that have that, and people are, and we're slowing down the pipeline of new users because there's more attention to that this is a dead end, that you're not going anywhere by going down this track. So if you're starting, you need to, you know, get the treatment before it's too late. If you're already there and addicted, the things we can do to try to address it, and we put more money into treatment in the last couple of years, and we just announced a large amount of state and federal money that's going to go into treatment facilities, including a 24-hour stabilization center in Baltimore City, the first of its kind in this state and really one of a few in the nation, to start that process of address, as well as sober housing or transitional housing for that person who goes through treatment, but they don't need to go right back to their neighborhood or right back to those stresses and stimuli that may cause them to regress. So we're doing those things. So I'm trying to be positive, but it's a long struggle.
It is a long struggle. Only about a minute left, Lieutenant Governor. We're in a hyper political time in this country, incredibly polarized as we head into the midterms in 2018. What is your confidence level that you and Governor Hogan, Republicans, can operate effectively with your Democratic colleagues as we go forward to get things done in the state and in Baltimore City specifically?
Well, you know, I think we can look at the record over the last 2.5 years, almost 3 years, that we have been able to get things done. We have been able to improve the quality of life for a lot of Marylanders. And we think that, you know, as long as we continue to do the right thing, the people will understand. Now, there's going to be the politics, and we're going to have folks that are going to, the naysayers, because they're trying to get a position, they want to be something. And so they're going to criticize what we do. But in most cases, what folks are doing, they're criticizing our party and our affiliation, but not what we do. You know, a lot of folks like what we've been able to do in the economy, the fact that, like you said, we're focusing on the heroin issue and drug issue generally. We're trying to bring about revitalization in the city and bring about jobs in the city. We passed the More Jobs for Marylanders Act, which provides tax incentives for businesses to move to and grow in Baltimore City, as well as Western Maryland and Lower Eastern Shore. So people like what we're doing, and the critics, for the most part, are trying to link us to Mr. Trump.
Well, that's
which we didn't support him.
Well,
that, so it means that's the only thing they have. They're not concerned about what we do. They probably like what we're doing, quite frankly.
Then we will leave it on that note. Lieutenant Governor Boyd Rutherford of Maryland. Lieutenant Governor, thank you so much for sharing your time with us this afternoon.
We appreciate it again.
I'm all for that.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you, Lieutenant Governor. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, the Mod Squad will be here. That's Ted Graham and Stephen Janis of the Real News Network. Stay tuned. You're listening to First Edition. Sean Yeos, your host, making the transition from my conversation with Lieutenant Governor Boyd Rutherford to the Mod Squad.
The Mod Squad, yes.
That's Stephen Janis and Ted Graham of the Real News Network. Friends, good to see you.
Good to see you, Sean.
Glad to be here, Sean. Thank you.
Yeah. I don't know how much of the conversation you heard.
I was listening to it, yes.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Interesting about the compare. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, you go ahead.
Well, he was just talking about how we have as many overdose deaths as we did in the 70s.
Yeah. More. He's
more.
Suggesting,
I said more. And then he says we're just finding out about this. So.
Well, I mean, he to his credit, he made the point that hey, Baltimore has been a heroin town since he was a little boy.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's clear on it. It just, you know, when the alarm sounds, you know that there's a different population that's being affected.
Absolutely.
Yes.
That's all.
Right.
Then that's not his fault.
No.
You know, it is what it is.
Yeah.
So the mayor, we were talking about the mayor and the fact that she met with Governor Hogan, I believe it was actually end of last week.
It was Monday.
Right.
Monday because we were working on the fast story, and she met with him down in Annapolis.
Right.
And had a press conference shortly thereafter.
Right. The week before he came here, I believe.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So.
And shortly after, Brandon Scott, you know, had a sort of abruptly ended a council meeting saying there was no plan for crime.
Yeah.
Which is,
and that's a
well,
yeah,
I mean, that's
that
a
incredible.
That's this is not the first time this city has had that debate over, you know, whether you have a plan. As everyone might recall, Kiefer Mitchell was very critical of then Mayor Sheila Dix's plan, which was like a 17-page PowerPoint.
Yeah.
And made a big deal about it down at City Hall. So crime plans. But go ahead.
Something else that the Lieutenant Governor mentioned I thought was interesting. He pointed directly at Martin O'Malley as mayor.
I missed that.
No, yeah. He said specifically, you know, there was a he said there was a former mayor that locked up that locked up 17% of the city's population.
Oh, I wonder who that could have been referring to.
Yeah.
There's only one person that fits that description. And he said that, you know, that was obviously a mistake and we had to go in. So there's that.
Yes.
That is interesting.
By the Lieutenant Governor.
That's good. Yeah. But did he mention any reparations for that particular mistake?
Well, that, but you know, and that's something we have to keep leaning on.
Yes.
You know?
Well, I think what you see, you know, with crime, when you ask for crime plans, you kind of tend to get pseudo events out of them. You know, where people try to, I mean, if you have a police department that's getting $500 million, you made your crime plan. There it is. I'm going to spend
that's
all my money
point.
On the police department.
That's a good point.
That's my crime plan.
We mentioned that too.
What do you, so what did he say? Not that people weren't listening.
Nah,
I'm sorry.
He, I mean, you know, I don't know if he, well, he knew that there was a debate about whether or not police would get more money.
I informed him that they
actually did get $17 million more.
Right. Plus the stuff that goes for the consent decree.
Right. But that's where the conversation came about. We have to kind of change how we do stuff.
Yeah.
So
yeah, that is your crime plan. I mean, you know, our colleague Jezel Norris spent a lot of time studying the Rose Street and the crime, you know, what they call cure violence model. And if the city, you know, as we all know, in the last council, in the last budget hearing or the last budget process, the mayor specifically cut the money for safe streets. And we found out during our reporting that Stephanie Rawlings-Blake had never put any specific money for safe streets. It always came from grants. So I think it's clear what the city's crime plan is. I don't think anyone really needs to, and you know, the fact, and I don't want to jump the gun on this, but we're talking about what the mayor did today, shows that the crime plan is pretty clear. I don't think there's any doubt about that, in my mind.
That's a good point.
Yeah, I mean, if that's where you put your money, that's your plan,
right?
The, you spend your money to go to Las Vegas, your plan is to go to Las Vegas.
Your plan is to go to Las Vegas and spend some money.
Right.
That's my plan.
Right. It's not like, what's your plan?
But the point, I think, is, you know, I think I saw that the mayor said, oh, I do have a plan.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess people are asking, well,
where is it?
Can we see it? Where is the plan?
Well, wasn't it mentioned specifically that part of the plan that I heard was that she was planning on having, if you were found with a gun within range
of
a church?
Yeah, we're talking about. Yeah, the press conference today. Yeah.
A church or a school, that you would have a 1-year mandatory minimum sentence. And I think that's an interesting proposal. I understand the instinct there. You don't want someone who has a unlicensed handgun that shouldn't have a handgun around a church or a school. But it doesn't necessarily seem like that's going to be effective. I mean, and I also have a problem with determinate sentences as well.
Yeah. Well, and LBS released a statement saying, Leaders of Beautiful Struggle released a statement saying it was not going to help the situation, but
right. And as activists that I think many can agree upon are excellent, working towards positive goals in the city, I think their input should really be taken into account. But I mean, determinate sentencing has problems for a lot of reasons. I mean, it doesn't. If you have a mandatory sentence, then when you're in jail, there's no hope for rehabilitation. There's no reason for good behavior because you can't get out early. Things like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, the problems with determinate sentencing, including the fact that it's costly.
This came from T.J. Smith had released, who is a police spokesman, had just released an email just prior to this press conference about people who had been brought up on gun charges, had been released or had gotten, you know, shorter sentences and then been arrested subsequently with a gun shortly thereafter.
True.
So there were like 600 some odd cases. And I think that's where I'm just giving
that's,
you word.
That's where the police department
has said, you know, this is a problem. However,
but that lack of flexibility there with a determinate sentence is problematic because it doesn't allow the judge to take into consideration that person's situation, that person's background, that person's life.
But I think the substance of that proposal is, Yeah. 1 year, what?
Yeah, 1 year mandatory.
1 year mandatory, and I think $1,000 fine.
I used to teach in my media literacy class at Towson University. Daniel Bornstein, is it Bornstein or Bornstein?
Bornstein,
who wrote a book called Pseudo Events in America, where he said, you know, the media is moved by pseudo events, where you call a press conference. And there's a certain characteristics of pseudo events, which are just fake, not fake.
Don't use the F word.
No.
Don't use the F word.
Contrived, where the things are contrived to keep the media busy and to manage what he called our extravagant expectations. And, you know, when you have a press conference, and the mayor, it was interesting that Marilyn Mosby wasn't there, but you have the mayor, the police commissioner, and, you know, there's this proposal.
And it gives the impression that something's occurring, that we are going to make progress, that we are actually
making progress. And I think that's part of what this is. You know, there's been pressure on the mayor, and suddenly she says, well, it's not like.
I don't really know what kind of impact this would really have on the people who are actually the violent offenders who are carrying the guns.
Well, look. So,
like, would it really be a deterrent?
We know that Baltimore City Police haven't had a problem taking guns off of the street.
No, the Gun Trace Task Force was amazing.
That's the other part of it. And reselling them.
And
redistributing.
I'm not trying to be cute about it, but I'm saying, I mean, taking guns off the street has not been an issue. But the thing that strikes me as odd about this is that, okay. If you come within a certain range of a church or a school with a gun, we're gonna
suddenly
lock you up for a year.
Yeah,
the issue isn't. I mean,
bizarre and arbitrary,
right? Like,
yeah.
I mean, it's like a feel-good proposal.
The old drug laws, the old war on drug laws, where it's like, you know, there was like 10 times punishment if you were near a school or something. Is it?
But it's just a feel good proposal, as you said. It's kind of a contrivance.
Yeah.
I mean, okay. So what's next?
Unfortunately, something not very good is next. You had written the story about the young man who was murdered by
Lieutenant Collins,
who went to Bowie State, but he was murdered, stabbed to death at the University of Maryland. I believe he was 23 years old. He had just graduated. Unfortunately, there's been another murder of a young black man who was just graduating from the University of Arizona. He was murdered in Greece by a group of young men. So he was in Greece with a few of his friends at a bar, enjoying themselves, and there was some misunderstanding, perhaps a flirtation with a waitress, and he and his friends left. And by the way, he's African American. His name's Bakari Henderson, 22 years old, and he left with his white friends from the bar. But he was chased out of the bar by eight or nine men, thrown against a car, kicked and beaten, and in the course of about 30 seconds, he was beaten so badly he was killed.
Yeah.
Well,
and he was there in Greece to do a photo shoot. He was vacationing and doing a photo shoot because he had just opened a new business. He's an entrepreneur selling a line of clothes.
And he just graduated with a degree in business.
And he had been at the University of Arizona on a full scholarship. So this was a promising young man, an entrepreneur.
And so and we can connect those cases for a couple of reasons. But one of them is that we got the news that the man who is charged with the murder of Lieutenant Collins.
Yes, Urbanski.
Urbanski will not be charged with a hate crime.
Absolutely. And even though he was connected to the alt-Reich through all of his social media, through all of the various places that he logged in and all the various ways that you can show your allegiance on social media, he was connected to neo-Nazis, white supremacy, alt-right.
Was he a student too?
He was at Duke University. Yeah.
That's the thing. Like, you had the student from friend's school, from Hamden, who drove up to New York.
Yeah, and killed
this 60-something. Extremely disturbing that you have. You know, you think you go to college and you become a little more enlightened, and you have a chance to be around other people. Create this idea of the extremists or racially motivated extremists being people who are like sort of out of that mainstream,
right? Hiding somewhere in a bunker in the woods somewhere out in the West.
I think it's a really, really disturbing trend that these people are college educated and
absolutely
in an environment where you think they would be the most likely to understand.
Sure. You would think that some sort of understanding. Yeah, you would think that going to college would give you an opportunity to be around people with diverse backgrounds, living near a city. But, you know, research has shown that millennials, that this generation is not so different than the previous generation when it comes to racism and harboring feelings of prejudice and white supremacy.
Well, they'll have you believe that they don't see race, but
Oh, but they do.
Devil is a liar. The devil is a liar.
I've got the stats.
Yeah. Let's take some phone calls. People want to get into the conversation. Let's go to Oscar first. He's been holding on the longest. Oscar, you are on First Edition with Mod Squad. How you doing, Oscar?
I'm doing great.
All right.
The situation in the universe of Merlin and in Greece, what is the moral of this story? What should we take away from these stories?
That young black men are an endangered species?
Nah. Well, no? that's one of the storylines.
Right.
But I'm saying, what is it with these black people that they have to go places and get with a lot of white people? And because they're with one white person who smile at them, they say, well, white people like me. I can go somewhere. I can go for my friends.
Are you saying that an African-American shouldn't feel comfortable traveling because there might be a chance that white people...
I didn't say you shouldn't feel comfortable traveling, but what do you say? That was flirtation with the waitress.
Possible flirtation.
And white men don't like that.
No,
they don't like you flirting with their women.
Well,
many a black person is in there great because that. You know,
true.
In my yard last week, I saw three Robin Redbreast beating up a blue jay. That's the truth. What does that tell you? God, the creator of mankind, say stay with your own kind.
Birds
That's
of a
what
feather.
He's saying.
I hear you, Oscar. I hear you. And I get what you're saying. But at the same time, for Lieutenant Collins, if he's on the campus of the University of Maryland with friends to go to a graduation, he has the right to be there. He shouldn't be stabbed to death because of
it. He has the right to go anywhere.
I hear what you're saying. I know what you're saying.
Common sense.
Okay.
Now, one other thing. Let me say this before I go.
All right.
I heard the lieutenant governor talking about somebody arresting 70% of the people in Baltimore.
17%, yes, of the population of Baltimore. Yeah,
guess
you know who we're
that.
Talking about. Yeah,
guess
I know.
Who did
we know. You know who. We know who did it.
From New York.
Well, yes, 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 yes.
It wasn't Martin O'Malley. Martin O'Malley didn't arrest a single person.
It was
talking over each other. What do you say?
It was Ed Norris. You're right. It was him.
It's no question. I'm always right. It definitely was Ed Norris and Kevin Clark, because when they came here, they said when they pulled up on a corner and people wouldn't run, they said, we're going to put an end to that because they came from We Own the Night. They're the people who killed Amadou Diallo in New York.
No doubt.
So when people say, and Martin O'Malley doesn't matter who, what mayor it was, it's going to be the same thing because you want to know what the plan is to lock up as many black people as they possibly can.
All right,
that's
Oscar.
All the mayor.
All right. You got it. You got it, Oscar. You got all of it. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to First Edition here on WEAA 88.9. I'm Sean Yose, your host. I'm in the studio with the Mod Squad. That's Taya Graham and Stephen Janis of the Real News Network. We're talking politics and law enforcement. Let's go to Lee next. He actually was holding on a long time. I think he had a question for the lieutenant governor, but let's see what Lee has to say now. Lee, you are on First Edition. How you doing?
How y'all doing? Yeah, you let them off hook too easy, man.
Well, you didn't want me to beat the hell out of him, did you? This is his first time on the show.
Nah, but what I'm just saying is, like, he come out and say, you know, they talking about, well, almost 18 million or whatever, to tear down the houses. He talking about putting parks and playgrounds. Man, our kids need computers and education. You know what I'm saying? That's what they need. They don't need no park. They can go to Drill Park, Carroll Park, or another park. Them kids need education. And that's the problem today, why these kids coming up now off the hook and out of chain, they're not getting a proper education. Well, I wanted to say to him, you know, when he come in the inner city, like East Baltimore, West Baltimore, go there like Park Avenue, you know, areas like that, you don't see what you see in the inner city. I mean, that's still the city, but you don't see in that area what you see in Sandtown. In parts of East Baltimore.
Well, Lee, to his credit, I would say that, I mean, he talked about Sandtown and being over there, and that's why they're trying to convert some of those vacants into parks and everything. But he also said, to his credit, that the money that is going to North Avenue, which is a lot of it, is not getting to the people who needs it. And that's a problem.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, and you know where it's going? It's going down Harbor East.
Well, there may be some truth to that. I don't disagree.
And we also need to bring to attention that that it's two Baltimores.
More days, two Baltimores. And you must have been looking at my notes, Lee, because I was going to bring that up too.
But I'm just keeping it real.
No, I know.
And they talking about the drugs. Like you say, the drugs been going on from back in the day. But like I say, the white kids start coming down here, dying in the old den. The governor got in there. He want to add a couple of programs, put money here and there. But still, we still, no disrespect to the LGBT. They came along and got things that they got that we've been trying to get for years.
All right, Lee, thank you for your call. We appreciate it.
All right, thanks.
Yes, sir. Let's see. Let's go to Clarence next. Clarence, you're on with the Mod Squad. How you doing?
I'm fine. Thanks for taking the call,
sure,
Sean.
Sure.
You know, black folks traveling around the world now, whether you've got the money to travel, you need to do your homework or tell your kids to do their homework and choose and think about where they're going at. Because that brother had no business in Greece. Greece is under siege. I think the name of the organization is Golden Dawn or something like that. Greece, the government in Greece is under siege by these neo-Nazis. They have basically taken the position that they don't want you in their country if you're not from Greece. They've beaten
That's
up
true.
Africans who
That's
open
true.
Up shop there.
That's true.
Anybody, they call them others. That brother should have known if he had done his research. And I feel for the brother. He lost his life, right? But that is something that black folks should be aware of. There's a lot of places I would like to go on this planet, but I ain't going unless I can carry 9mm on both hips. And that ain't even going
to
help.
Well, where would you say is safe for a young black person to be able to travel?
There's lots of places, I think. I don't
lots.
Know.
There are lots of places, but the Middle East, definitely not. Because there's an underlying, even, you know, Muslims would argue against me, but I'm a firm believer in that what our American Muslims believe and what the Muslims in the Middle East believe about us are totally different things. So, no, the Middle East, I wouldn't go mm-hmm. right at this particular time. And definitely not Greece and Britain.
All right.
For instance, you are subject to the same racial profiling in Britain as black people are there as they are in America.
All right, Clarence, thank you. Thank you for your call. We appreciate it. The immigration backlash has been well documented in Europe, but mm-hmm. in some parts of Europe, but Greece also.
Greece has been having some real problems.
Tremendous problems for years. People traveling to Greece via sea, mm-hmm. and it's been a few years since there have been major backlashes against immigration, especially immigration from African nations.
Absolutely, so. And they are having trouble passing like any sort of hate crime legislation to protect both LGBT people and people of color. They've been having difficulty passing it.
Let's go to Charles next. Charles, you're on with the Mod Squad. How you doing?
All right. I'm sure that Rutherford is still listening, so this is for him.
All right.
I'm sure he knows. I'm sure you know, Rutherford, that 90% of black people are not going to vote for someone who is upholding the policies of the Republican Party. I'm sure you know that. So don't talk about this. I mean, he has never talked about people vote for party. Well, he votes for party. He's a Republican. He votes for party because he belongs to the party. He believes in that ideology and their policies. We do not. Finally, look, Sean.
Yes, sir.
You all keep laughing about how many people were locked up under formalities.
Oh, slow down.
Not true.
No, we're not laughing about that.
I would never laugh
I've
about
written
that.
For years and talked for years and we fought for years against what happened as far as zero tolerance. So don't say that, Charles. That's disrespectful.
That's disrespectful. The person's name that we knew.
I apologize.
All right. Thank
okay,
you. Thank you. Thank
I didn't
you.
Hurt anybody's feelings.
No, you didn't hurt our feelings. The reality is that's our work, man. And we've been doing hard work. And lots of times we've been kind of alone and isolated in doing that work, Charles. So don't do that.
Okay.
Don't do that.
Okay. Let me say this now. All right.
Go ahead.
You're one of your buddies, Doc Cheatham.
Okay.
And others on the air right now, screaming at Kevin Davis, complaining about our open air drug market.
Yes.
Okay. So what is what Doc Cheatham wants? He wants black people to be locked up.
Well, I mean, he don't.
You need to say something. You need to talk to your buddy. That's
I think he doesn't. I think he doesn't want open air drug markets, Charles. Do you want open air drug markets?
He doesn't want open air drug markets. That's why black people voted for Malcolm
McDonald. All right, Charles. All right.
Well, I mean, you know, it does show the dilemma you're dealing with, right? I mean, why it's so difficult to change policies and change philosophy, make this change that a lot of people have advocated for, because you have the immediacy of an open-air drug market or a crime, a murder. It brings an immediate reaction. The problem is, of course, if you start screaming at the police to do more, we know what that means. And you can't even blame the police if they do more, if you ask them to do more as a community. Right. If we say, arrest more people, go disrupt that corner, we're going to get what we ask for. And I think that, you know, don't you? I mean, I'm
I'm just laughing.
And I mean, Doc Cheatham was someone who was very outspoken against zero tolerance.
Absolutely.
He was one of the few people I could quote in the city, and he was part of the lawsuit against the police department by the NAACP and the ACLU that sued them in 2006.
The thing I'm laughing about right now is that why would you disparage Doc or anybody for trying to get open air drug markets closed down?
Well, I think what he's saying is, you know,
you can't arrest your way out. I guess,
right. And he's probably concerned that if we keep pulling the tiger by the tail, you know, it's gonna react the way we had in the past. And he said that fear was what gave Martin O'Malley a victory.
That's absolutely true.
And so it's not a bad thing to think about that through before you start saying please, that you have to think about it. There are consequences to that. I mean,
of course,
we can't blame police if we ask for those policies.
I agree 100%. My point is simple. Mm-hmm. Is simply that the existence of open air drug markets would not be tolerated anywhere else.
That is very true.
I haven't seen any open air drug markets in Roland Park lately. Ooh,
Roland Park
analogies.
We used
to say it all the time. Would they arrest 7-year olds in Roland Park? No. Right. Would they tolerate? No. I mean, you just could go down the list. There is no doubt about that, Sean. There is no doubt about that.
Let's go to Thomas next in Churchville. Thomas, you're on with the Mod Squad. How you doing? Thomas, are you there? I guess
Thomas is not there.
Did we lose Thomas?
He may be. I didn't know. Let's try again. Can we get Thomas in Churchville?
Yeah, sure.
There we go. Got you. All right, go ahead, Thomas.
Good evening.
You're fading in and out, Thomas.
We're having a technical difficulty. I have to say, I'm kind of concerned about one of what your callers earlier mentioned, that black people need to do research before they travel. Well, of course someone needs to research before they travel, but where exactly is a young black person supposed to be safe? I mean,
it sounds like the Green Book.
Exactly. It sounds like that Green Book that, you know, African Americans used to, back in the days of Jim Crow, they would say, well, this is the gas station that it's safe to stop at. This is the hotel room that's safe to go to. This is the restaurant where you can stop and eat. And you would have to plan your entire trip based off of where you could stop, where there were safe places. Well where are our safe places now?
And I think that's a really valid point. You know why? Because we've seen the rise of intolerance as far as backlash against immigration for years, even before Trump.
Right.
Once Trump came, that really kind of set the tone.
Yes.
Because the rest of the world looked at Trump, the ascendance of him as president of the United States, and said, we really can,
free to do that. And
nationalism is alive and well.
Yes, the jingoism, and it's really quite scary. I mean, the more research that I was doing on Greece and seeing that the members of their parliament have like openly allied themselves with the neo-Nazi movement and that Golden Dawn that he was referring to. And even I think there was one MP who was quoted on record as saying that Hitler had a great personality. I mean, they're just these amazing statements that are being made that are they aren't trickling down. It's a trickle up from the rest of the population that is feeling this anti-immigrant fervor. And that applies to all dark-skinned peoples.
Well, Greece has had a tremendous economic, not just stagnation, absolute collapse. And it's usually what happens.
And
just like Trump
there.
Blames immigrants, blames minorities,
and whips up that fervor.
In the closed steel plants out in the Midwest, you know, pick that up. And it's the same thing in Greece, probably the same dynamic.
Absolutely true. And I had almost forgotten about the economic collapse of Greece.
Yeah.
And once there's an economic collapse, it's always, they always blame black people for it.
Almost went bankrupt if Europe had to bail them out, or the European Union.
I mean, think about it. Right now, we're dealing with the deindustrialization, the loss of these important factories and manufacturing centers, production centers in our own country, and who's being blamed? Well, it's the Mexicans. Are you sure it's not greedy corporations who have decided that manufacturing overseas is much better for their profit margin and their bottom line?
It's weird because Ohio's unemployment rate is extremely low. I mean, I don't even really understand where this is coming from, if that's the case, you know? It's just weird.
Let me take another phone call. Let's go to Keith White in South Carolina. Keith, you're on.
Seriously?
Yeah, you're on with the
Mod Squad. Down there.
How you doing?
How you doing?
All right, bro.
Oh, this is how you doing, Mr. Yost? My question is to the three of you. You had Mr. The governor, the lieutenant governor on that day. Uh-huh. What the three? You know, what do you think is going to be the ultimate plan, or what do you think Governor Hogan is really going to do to make you help the control of violence in Baltimore? I mean, like, really, do you really think it will come down to martial law, sending in the National Guard if you have to? That's my question.
Keith, thank you for your call and your question. The governor said he would not send in the National Guard. The governor said he would not send in state police because they're not trained to do law enforcement in urban areas. I don't know what the state can really do, if much of anything.
No, I mean, the state could pour a lot of money into drug treatment.
They could disperse some funds.
Or they could, you know, work with the health department to fund things like Safe Streets and cure violence programs. I mean, yeah, you're right. I don't think the governor wants to get entangled in that kind of stuff. I don't think he wants National Guard people shooting people in Baltimore City. I just don't think there's no upside.
It's not a good look.
No. There's no upside to that for him. So, so I don't think there's going to be much.
So we have to do what we have to do. Mod Squad is Stephen Janis and Taya Graham of the Real News Network. Friends, good to see you as always.
Always good to be here. Thank
you,
Sean.
We'll see you Wednesday.
Yep.
Yes.
All right, good. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, the second hour, first edition, the world famous happy hour, the louder than a bomb spoken word crew, world champions, national champions, spoken word crew is going to be in the studio. They're from Baltimore, and we've got beats. They've got rhymes. We're going to do our thing. Stay tuned. You're listening to First Edition.